Greetings.
Blog Talk Radio.
I jumped the gun there. Greetings from Mount Olympus. This is Hercules Invictus, and today on Voice of Olympus, I'm honored to bring you Living Elinis Moss with Tony Mrazewicki. Greetings and welcome, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing really well, Hercules. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic, and I'm really looking forward to your show today.
So am I. We were very fortunate to have had Dr. Jan Pepler on the show in August to share her insights into Aphrodite. In that interview, we touched on Demeter and Persephone, but due to time constraints, we were unable to give them the attention they deserved. Jan has kindly agreed to come back on the show to remedy this. But first, a little bit of background for those who may have forgotten it. Jan received a bachelor degree with a focus on sacred mythologies from DePaul University and a master's and PhD in mythological studies and depth psychology from Pacifica Graduate Institute. Her dissertation, titled The Psychology of Home, An Archetypal Study of Relationship to Place, includes a chapter on Greek goddess archetypes as experienced through our mothers. Jan has always had a deep relationship with the divine that surpasses her Lutheran upbringing. By age 25, she had gathered a group of women to celebrate the Earth Holy Days, meeting monthly for 3 years. It was this group of women who helped officiate her wedding ceremony in 1995. Fundamentally, Jan sees all religions as frameworks for communicating with the divine, which is beyond our understanding, yet present always. We apply names and attributes to this holiest of holies in an attempt to bring ourselves into close relationship. As such, while she bristles at labels, she's probably an omnist more than anything. Jan has facilitated rituals and sacred ceremonies since the early 1990s. She has presented twice at the Parliament of World Religions, numerous times at the American Academy of Religion, and co-chaired the AAR Western Region Goddess Studies Unit. She founded the Joseph Campbell Mythological Roundtable of Ketchum, Idaho, and she continues to present on various topics, including the goddess and gods in popular culture, mythology, and the hero's journey and understanding home. Jan actually gave me some homework before this interview. Firstly, I read and reviewed Lost Goddesses of Early Greece by Charlene Spretnak, which I will be posting to my Pathias blog in the next few days. Secondly, she asked me to read an absolutely wonderful paper, which she has just posted to academia.edu, titled The Mother Archetype as Expressed in Demeter and Persephone. Jan, thanks for making yourself available and coming on the show. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Thank you, Tony. It's great to be back here with you.
I'm really looking forward to hearing from you again, and I know Hercules is as well. So I wanted to start off by saying that I really enjoyed your paper. You pointed out that our birth mothers are obviously first and foremost the carriers of the mother archetype. However, this can change if the biological mother is unwilling or unable, and the child may be provided with another adult, such as a nanny, a grandparent, or the father, who may manifest the mother archetype in her place. Any of these people may serve the role of the archetypal mother, nurturing, protective, attentive, loving, and constant. I found myself remembering an anecdote from a friend years ago. She had been employed as a nanny in a wealthy household where she looked after a child, whose gender I've forgotten because it was quite a few years ago. She would feed, play with, entertain, and even repair and alter clothing for the child. On one occasion, while the mother was home, the child injured itself while playing and ran past the shocked mother into the arms of my friend for comfort. The child obviously looked upon my friend as more of a mother archetype than her biological mother. Is this sort of thing common in your experience, and are there any other lessons to be learned?
Absolutely. That can be a common occurrence, especially as you have babysitters or nannies in the home. Though I'm sure this was devastating for the child's mother, right?
Yes.
But before I forget, I want to just also note that many of us are adopted and we don't even know our birth mothers, right? So,
right.
We may come to know our birth mother only when we're older, which means she has never functioned or acted in the mother archetype. So just to be really clear between the mother and the archetypal mother. But back to your story, as you mentioned, any person has the potential for embodying the mother archetype. And if you don't feel that your mother was particularly loving or nurturing, you can always consider who else was in your life when you were a child that may have fulfilled that role. You know, was it a grandparent, a teacher, an older sibling, a neighbor, or, as in your story, a nanny? And we actually see nannies a lot in history, with especially with wealthy families or white families in the Old South, right? Nannies take care of the children and assume the mother archetype. But also thinking about the mother in your story, it's actually possible. I mean, I'm sure when that happened, that was devastating. But it's possible that that occurrence shifted something in her. It is always possible that later she may have learned to step into the mother archetype. You know, that experience alone can enact a change that allows the archetype to manifest. Or if that was her first child, and she goes on to have more children, sometimes the archetype doesn't kick in until the last child, or sometimes it doesn't kick in until there are grandchildren, right? You know, many times you hear somebody say, my mother was not a good mother, she was awful, but man, she's the perfect grandma. So... yeah, it can happen at any time, or it can not happen at all, and it can happen with any person, regardless of gender.
In your paper, you point out that the archetypal mother in Greek mythology is Demeter, mother of the young maiden Persephone. You quote Jean Shinoda Bolen, author of Goddesses in Every Woman, who points out that Demeter finds fulfillment through providing nourishment to others, physically, psychologically, or spiritually. She's typically not ambitious or competitive and doesn't care about rank, title, or status. Her entire motivation is in helping others grow or get well. In many households to this day, mothers enjoy food preparation and seeing their families and visitors well fed. This seems to be particularly true among the Italians I've met. You probably came across this during your Italian sojourn?
Well, more than that, because most of my sojourn, again, remember, was during pandemic. And so I was in lockdown and isolation like everyone else was. But more than that, I was married to an Italian. And my mother-in-law's, or mother-in-love, I used to call her, my mother-in-love's home, was always the center of family activity. And, you know, I used to joke, I didn't recognize that as an Italian trait for the longest time. I just thought that this was incredibly bizarre and so unlike my own upbringing, that we were constantly at her house. And every month, maybe every 3 weeks, there was some birthday celebration and all of that. So, yes, it definitely is an Italian trait. But this is true in a lot of cultures, not just Italian. Asian, Black, Hispanic, you know, mama is in the kitchen cooking. And big family dinners on Sundays is a must, right? So that is definitely... Yes. The mother archetype right there. In Chicago, I lived in Chicago. I was actually raised in Chicago and then lived there for a while as an adult. But there's a wonderful blues bar named Rosa's. I highly recommend it to anybody who's ever in Chicago. It's named after the mother of the proprietor, Tony Mangiulo. And, you know, they're from Italy. It's a great story how they got over here. But I lived with Mama above the bar for a few months, which is an interesting story in of itself. But to the point, every night after the bar closed, after we had cleaned up the bar and everyone had left and the money had been counted, we would go upstairs and Mama would start cooking. It would be 4 o'clock in the morning. It would just be me and her adult son, who was married, lived with his wife somewhere else, and she would be cooking for him. And there was a point when I left and Mama said she wanted to go to Italy for a month, asked if I would come back and help run the bar with her son for that month. And the funniest part of that was he actually expected that I would step into that role and cook for him. And Lauren's like, that ain't happening.
But so many guys are like that. When they look for a partner, they look for a representation of their mother, someone to step into their mother's shoes.
Well, that's very true. But what you said is actually two different things. If your mother is, we do tend to look for, as men, our mothers, as women, our fathers. And that's a whole different conversation, which is really interesting. And it does have to do with archetypes as well and with home. But in particular, in this case, if your mother embodied the mother archetype, and I guess that's where I want to be really clear, not all mothers do, okay? You can be a mother and not be a bad mother, but not fully embody that mother archetype. And I think I mentioned this a little bit last time. My mother really manifested the Athena archetype. And, you know, Athena was never a child herself. She never had children. She was a warrior. She was strategic. She was brilliant. But that whole kind of cookies in the oven and, you know, arms stretched out when you came home and that kind of thing, that wasn't my mother. And she was not the cook in the house. So if your mother you go after what your mother was in some cases, right? So if your mother was that one that cooked, then, yeah, you darn well are looking for a mate who will also create that kind of home life as well. Yeah.
Cool. Are there any other important features of Demeter's role as a mother archetype?
Well, I guess what I was just about to say is, there's also Demeter often overlaps with Hestia. Now, we'll remember Hestia was the firstborn, but then also the first swallowed. Hestia. And so she spent the longest time alone by herself. Hestia, while Demeter is associated with home, Demeter is associated with mother. Hestia is associated with home. And because Demeter, as mother, is our first home, there can sometimes be some overlapping there, right? Hestia is the home hearth. The womb is, you know, that warm place. Demeter nurtures and grows us and makes things as this, you know, fertile womb. But then Hestia also is that fire that cooks that into something nurturing. So anyway, there can be an overlap there. What was your question again? Are there other important features of Demeter's role as the mother? Well, I guess the one thing I want to point out, because we always think of her as loving and nurturing, and probably this stands out for me because I am so not comfortable with chaos or with noise, but Demeter is. Demeter is perfectly comfortable with all the chaos that comes with children in the house, with children running around, with screaming voices, with toys on the floor. She doesn't mind that stuff. As the goddess of life is chaotic, And she kind of just rolls with that noise and that messiness. So because it's so not me, I really think that's one of the brilliant things about Demeter. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that I love to give pop references or pop culture references to this. So, but I'm gonna dig deep for this. If you go all the way back to, I think it's about 1868, something like that, is when Louisa May Alcott wrote Little Women. And it's only interesting because this story is so endearing that it continues to get remade into movies regularly. But in Little Women, the mother, who is called Marmee, she's a great example of that Demeter archetype. She's extraordinarily loving and calm and nurturing. Her four daughters are very dramatic. They all have different personalities. There's always some chaos going on. And she never loses her cool. And she goes out and does all this charity work. And she takes care of her husband when he's sick. She takes care of the household when the husband's not even around, all that kind of stuff. So she's a great example of Demeter. Let me see, was there anything else I wanted to say to you? Again, back to important features of the Demeter as mother. I really, again, want to stress that the mother archetype can be embodied in anybody. It can show up in anyone regardless of their gender. Again, here's another movie for you. I don't know if you ever saw the Eddie Murphy film from 2016. It was very much under the radar. It's called Mr. Church. And in it, he plays a man who is hired to make meals for a woman and her daughter as the woman is dying. And he ends up being there for like 6 years, and he makes all this food, and he nurtures her, and he nurtures her love of reading, which leads to her going to college, and blah, 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 blah. It's a really sweet story, though, and he is very clearly embodied by the Demeter archetype. So, again, man in that role, anybody can be in that role.
I think you've given me more homework. I think you've given me more homework. I've got another movie I've got to watch. So getting back on track, in your paper, you discussed the negative aspect of the mother archetype, which can be destructive, expressed by over-controlling or withholding nourishment. Do you see this in the myth of the abduction of Persephone?
Oh, absolutely. In the myth as most of us know it, which is the myth that was recorded in a patriarchal culture, both of these expressions of withholding and over-controlling and being destructive are present. So first, the withholding of nourishment. Remember, Demeter is responsible for all crops. Romans knew her as Ceres, which pretty obviously is where we get our English word cereal from.
Mm-hmm.
During the whole ordeal, when her daughter is abducted and she can't find her, Demeter orders the crops to stop growing. So in this place, she is withholding nourishment to everyone, to the entire world. She is first and foremost mother of the world, right? She nurtures, she nourishes the whole world. So that's the first thing she does. And at first, this is due to grief. So, you know, that's a pretty acceptable response in our grief, that we are just simply unable to nurture others. But then the withholding of the crops becomes part of her negotiation to get her child back. So then it becomes a very conscious withholding. And, you know, perhaps you've seen this or experienced this. This is the mother who gets really upset for her child growing up or not needing her, and then she withholds her love. You know, she'll give her the silent treatment or she'll ignore her. I got another movie for you, Lady Bird, but we'll come back to that. But honestly, actually, recently, I just saw this play out around a wedding. Friends were getting married, and the mother of the bride felt like she was not being consulted enough, like she didn't have a say in the wedding planning. And her daughter was really clear about what she wanted for the wedding and what she needed, particularly around COVID-19 and pandemic restrictions. But all of this, it was not what her mother had in mind. And eventually her mother just said something to the effect of, well, you know, maybe I just won't attend at all. It sounds like you don't want me there, so I just won't come, which of course made the daughter back down and change her plans because of course she wanted her mother to be at her wedding. But that is that manipulative play of withholding nourishment that the Demeter archetype can do in the negative, right, when she gets triggered. She'll punish the child by withholding love. Okay, I'm going to bring up Lady Bird again. it's a 2017 film, and I can't remember the actresses' names because one I can't even pronounce. But it's a fabulous kind of coming of age film, and the mother and daughter are really Demeter and Persephone, and the daughter is at this point in her senior year of high school and pulling away from her mother. You know, they live in Sacramento. The daughter just says, I hate Sacramento. It's the Midwest of California. And I want to go where there's culture. I want to go out east. And her mother, in an attempt to, because she's triggered and she's afraid of losing her daughter, so an attempt to keep her, control her, she does a similar kind of withholding by actually belittling her daughter. She says to her daughter, you're not smart enough to go to school. You don't have any talent. You're a snob, you know, so on and so forth, which is awful. And then sure enough, when the daughter does get accepted into college out east, the mother just stops talking to her altogether. It's a very good film. That's more of your homework. But we also see, so in the myth itself, in the Demeter and Persephone myth, we see this controlling mother played out in another way. So before Persephone returns, Demeter becomes a nurse, a wet nurse to a wealthy family. And this part of the story is often overlooked. The Demeter archetype always needs to nurture someone. So when her daughter is gone, she accepts this job. Interesting how she gets this job, but she accepts this job as a wet nurse. And then while the mother is asleep, she holds the child in the fire in order to make it immortal. Now, while this may be a wonderful gift that only Demeter as a goddess can bestow, you know, hey, your son's going to be immortal. The truth is, she was doing it for selfish reasons. She was really looking for a replacement for her own daughter. Can you see that? Right? And then the mother walks in, she's horrified, and makes Demeter stop. So this is the over-controlling aspect of Demeter that we sometimes forget. She can assume that she knows what is best not only for her own child, but for everyone else too.
Going off on a bit of a tangent for a minute, in your paper you pointed out that two mothers in the Harry Potter series embody the Demeter mother archetype in quite contrasting ways. Petunia Dursley is Harry Potter's aunt, whose actions resemble the wicked stepmother in the Cinderella fairy tale. Mrs. Molly Weasley, on the other hand, is a wonderful expression of the caring Demeter mother archetype. With seven children of her own, ranging from 10 years old to adulthood, she willingly becomes a second mother to Harry, best friend of her son Ron. Would you like to compare these two mothers?
Well, that would take up the rest of our time. So I don't do that.
So just the Reader's Digest.
I think the comparison is pretty obvious, even in the question, right? One, Petunia, his aunt, when it comes to Harry, she's the wicked stepmother, whereas Mrs. Weasley is everything that the Demeter mother archetype, or the mother archetype and the Demeter archetype should be. She's just loving and fantastic and embraces him. And it comes up in several of the books where she becomes more and more attached to him as her own son. But I think the one thing that I want to point out, so I won't go into the whole comparison, but Petunia, who is Harry's aunt, who is just so awful to him and makes him live underneath the stairs and gives him hand-me-downs and all this kind of stuff, she's not only a bad mother to Harry, she is a poor mother to her own son, Dudley, as well. And she's that poor mother because she is overindulgent. A good mother is not overindulgent. A good mother, actually good parents, provide boundaries. They set boundaries for their children, and they stick to them for the sake of the child. It's kind of like somebody's going to come after me one day for this, I'm sure, but it always feels parenting, a good parent feels a bit to me like being a good puppy mom or dad. When I'm a strong believer in crates, the puppy needs to be in a crate when they are young because the world is way too big. And if you allow that puppy to have full reign of your house, everything gets chewed up. And that's just because they're scared and it's too big and you're not around. Whereas if you crate train a puppy and you put up with the cries and the whimpering when you go to bed, that crate becomes a safe place for the puppy. And there's the same thing with parents having to set boundaries for children. You have to say, no, you have to go to bed at this time, or you have to come home, or you can't eat that much, or so on and so forth. And that actually makes the world a safe place for the child. And it also then later gives the child something to push against in order to individuate, which is another topic. But I think that's the biggest thing between the two mothers is Petunia not only fails Harry, she fails her child, whom she thinks she's just loving so much, but she's over-loving and over-nurturing.
So getting back to the abduction story where Persephone is a lovely maiden out picking flowers with her friends when Hades, the god of the underworld, kidnaps her, it turns out that it was an arranged marriage with Hades having received permission from Zeus, who's Persephone's father. However, Demeter, Persephone's mother, was not consulted. We've already discussed this a little bit, but are there any other meanings you can infer from the story in the context of Demeter being the mother archetype?
Well, sometimes we need someone else to act on our behalf in order for us to separate from our mothers and mature or individuate. You know, when we're not able to do this on our own, very often the father will step in. In fact, the mother archetype is responsible for providing home, where the father archetype is responsible for us leaving home. So while from a very feminist perspective, you know, we read this classical version of the myth and think, are you kidding, Zeus? You jerk. You made this decision without consulting the mother. But the truth is, the mother already, in this version of the story, probably was not willing to accept any mate for her daughter. She didn't want to let go of her daughter. So in that case, there had to be an abduction or the father had to intercede. And we actually see this over and over again in myth. You know, in this myth, the father, Zeus, goes behind the mother's back. In fairy tales, it's often the father king who tells the son to go out on a quest. In Lord of the Rings, Gandalf is the father archetype to both Bilbo and to Frodo. And so he propels both of them to leave home. And, you know, even in the Christian story, Jesus leaves home at age 13. He separates from his parents and stays in the temple because he says when he's found, he must do his father's work. So this is actually a great topic, talking about the father archetype and Zeus. And I hope that I can come back and you'll let me talk about that another time. But I'll stop there for now. I mean, just to summarize, it's essential that the child separates from the mother in order to individuate. And sometimes in order for that separation to occur, if the mother is not willing to assist the child in that separation, she's resistant, then there has to be an abduction, or the father has to intercede, or the child will end up rebelling.
Yeah. Personally, I would love to have you back on the show maybe early next year if Hercules is willing.
Hercules is willing. Hercules is very willing.
The thing I love about what you just said was that Zeus had his many faults, but you've basically made him less of a villain in this particular story. It's a very interesting way of looking at the abduction myth. So I'm really grateful for that. I'm getting a lot out of this. There's an alternate version of the myth, of the abduction myth, presented by Charlene Spretnak in her book Lost Goddesses of Early Greece, which she suggests may be from pre-Hellenic times when myths were still oral traditions. In this tradition, the maiden is not abducted. Instead, Persephone chooses to descend to the underworld. What are the implications of this version?
Ah, yes. This is what you called the homework that I assigned to you.
Yes.
You know, this version actually means so much to me. I discovered this when I was 25 years old, so we're talking 30 years ago, and I was working in HIV and AIDS. My father had died from AIDS the year prior. I had a number of friends dying, and I was, you know, just plunged into the underworld, right? Into a grief that was unfathomable to me. My father, particularly because my father was a Demeter archetype for me. So, you know, not a typical role. Although in some ways he also very much was the father archetype, but we were very, very close. And so I discovered this when I was part of that ritual circle of women that you mentioned in the introduction. And it transformed my life. It gave meaning. That myth gave meaning to my experience. It articulated and validated my choice to work in HIV and AIDS. People said to me all the time, isn't this so hard to do? And it wasn't. It felt exactly what I needed to be doing at that time, and I was really good at it. And some of my strongest relationships today are still back from 30 years ago. But eventually, when the time was right, after I had worked in AIDS for over 4 years, I had grieved for 4 years. As you may know, grief comes and goes like waves. But working in AIDS as long as I did at a time when people burnt out in 18 months. I mean, this was an insane time in our history and in that pandemic. We see it now in the COVID pandemic, right? But after all that, I was finally able to choose something different for myself, and I decided to go to massage school. And I was very cognizant that I was shifting from Persephone to Demeter. Instead of helping people die, I was going to help people live. And that is the power of myth, finding the version of the story that speaks to our own experience. It validates our choices, it validates our pain, our achievements, and it provides a direction, a kind of roadmap or role model for how our story can evolve and improve. And when I, that's exactly what that version of the myth did for me, and I'm sure it's done for many others. Your life can change.
Yeah, if you go on Amazon and check out the reviews, a number of women have told how important that particular version of the various myths was to them. They found it incredibly empowering. And in this case, Persephone goes from being a victim to an empowered woman who's in charge of her own destiny.
Right.
So what do you see as the main differences between Persephone Kore, the maiden who was abducted, and Persephone, queen of the underworld, who willingly chose to go into the underworld?
Oh, well, you know, Kore, she is either abducted or rebels. So it's not her choice, whereas mm-hmm. Persephone, queen of the underworld, she makes it her choice. So the bottom truth is we all will at some point in time, in some way or another, experience a descent into the underworld. You know, I associate that mostly as the hero's journey, which is another thing we can discuss, even though it's not Greek mythology.
mm-hmm.
But there are plenty of places where it shows up, like Orpheus having to go down. But anyway, when we choose that descent as a rite of passage, as our initiation, it makes a huge difference how we experience that underworld, how we experience the loneliness or despair or separation from all that we knew. No, if we choose it ourselves versus if we are thrown into it. And simply by virtue of choosing it, we begin our individuation. Kore does not choose. And so she potentially can get stuck in the underworld as an unwilling victim. Whereas Persephone, who becomes queen of the underworld, having chosen her path in the Spretnak version, having said, I will go, despite her mother telling her how dangerous it is and everything else, she prepares herself and she goes. And while it is still lonely and dark and hard and difficult and emotional, she is sustained by her own strength and her own conviction. And that is part of the transformation. And that transformation then becomes so essential, not only for the individual's life, but according to the hero's journey, as we come back and then as we are transformed, we come back and transform those around us. So I think there's a really powerful difference between the two. And you mentioned my paper. I did upload that to academia.edu. And if you go and read the paper, which is admittedly 17 pages long, you'll get some more in-depth answer to the question, how the two versions, the impact that they can make in our lives.
Just before our interview, I actually uploaded a link to the paper. So anyone who I uploaded it as a comment. So anyone who's listening will be able to find the link and check the paper out. And on a personal note, I really enjoyed the paper. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it, and it's well worth reading for anyone who has an interest in the ancient Greek myths and also an interest in archetypes.
Thank you. You have to write a shorter version, a draft. just
so you've actually heavily extended it, have you?
I think you read about 12 pages. It's up to 16 or 17 with the end notes. But
knowing you, that's going to be 5 minutes of quality material. Sorry, 5 pages of quality material, not 5 pages of padding. So I'll have to reread it now.
Okay.
Given that there are no surviving pre-Hellenic oral traditions of the myths, and what we do have may well have been altered by Homer and Hesiod, who are renowned for having written the very earliest versions of the myths, how plausible are the alternate versions presented by Charlene Spredneck?
You know, myth is iterative. Myth always adapts to the times. I think it's more than plausible that some version of Spretnak's interpretation was in fact the story that was told before, you know, Greek patriarchy kind of took over. When Greeks come into power is when the, you know, what is it, about 800 BCE, somewhere in there, that we get writing. We get the alphabet and we get writing. And this is the problem with the written word. We tend to consider it as fact once it's written down. And I have to admit, I struggled with this myself in grad school and around this myth in particular. I kept asking my professors, one professor in particular, Dr. Christine Downing, she has written a lot about Demeter and Persephone. And I kept saying to her, well, but what is the real myth? What's the original myth? What's the true myth? And she just laughed because all the versions are real. They are all original. Wanting only one version to be the true version negates actually the whole purpose of myth and the purpose of story. The point of myth has always been to teach through metaphor. And if we can move past the idea of these stories, these myths being only true or false, then we can discover the treasure within. And this is when myth is most helpful. This is when and how we adapt the wisdom of these stories to our own lives. So it's extremely, I'd say it's more than plausible. I believe there are many, many versions of this myth and of all myths and stories that exist. And, you know, we only have a sliver of what those are, just from what remains in written text. But that's not the full. Think of any story that is, you know, just happened in the news in the last, or the story of the pandemic, right? Hundreds of years from now, the only story that's going to, if there's only one version or two versions that survive and people are reading it centuries from now, the pandemic is so multifaceted, right?
Absolutely.
There only be one or two stories. There's no one truth. Sorry, I could go on and on about that, but I think we're almost out of time, so I'm going to dial myself back.
I actually totally agree with you about the whole pandemic thing, because there have been a number of things which were offered as possibilities, which were denounced as conspiracy theories, and a year and a half later, all of a sudden, they're being thought of as plausible. And there's the version pushed by the extreme left, there's the version pushed by the extreme right, and I think that there are elements of truth in both. But again, we're just getting totally off topic here.
No, that's a really good point. Life is not true or false, black or white, either or. Life is always both and. Life is always more than it's not a competition of opposites, right? There's always much more to every story and much more to life. One of my favorite examples is, like, even as a mother, right? When we think about the mother archetype and about Demeter, and we could see some of her, we call some of her behaviors, the over-controlling and the devouring, as these negative or shadow aspects. And yet, those only come up because she loves her child so much. And then fear kicks in. She doesn't want her child to leave her prematurely. It's not like she's evil.
Yeah.
She's not a good mother or a bad mother. We're not good children or bad children, right? We are both and. We can love and nurture and support our children or anybody, and then at the same time do things to undermine them at times or to harm them or to hurt them. That is our human nature.
Yeah.
And so the myth, while we're dealing with gods and goddesses and divinity, they show up in these stories in very, very human ways. And the purpose of that is for us to understand ourselves and our behaviors and that of the culture around us.
You know, while you were talking, I found myself drifting off and thinking about extreme cases. Well, not drifting off as in falling asleep, but drifting off mentally. I don't laugh at me. I was thinking about extreme cases where you have addiction. So you may have a mother whose child is an addict, and the mother wants to keep nurturing the child, but by nurturing the child, they're enabling that child. So the child never breaks the addiction that they have. So, and as you know, with addiction, it's important for the addict to hit rock bottom. And by withdrawing love and stepping away, the mother is actually doing the right thing by the child. The child may not think it at the time, but it is the right thing to do. And
I'm going to cut in just to clarify one thing you said. I agree with you 100%, and please forgive me for cutting in, but I'm sure you're going to agree with me when you hear what I have to say. You said
sure.
by withdrawing love. And ultimately, and I'm very familiar with this, unfortunately, the parent is not withdrawing love. What they're doing is setting a boundary. And
yes.
Teaching the child consequences.
Yes.
And maybe that got missed somewhere along the way. But in that moment, with any addict, adult or child or anything, you the best way that you can love is to enforce boundaries, enforce rules, and enforced consequences. And that is the hardest thing to do. That, you know, that's where you almost fall into the Petunia scenario. You want to just keep loving and I'll make it better and I know you're hurting, but you can't. The child, like you said, we all have to hit bottom. We have to go through the descent into the underworld. We have to have our own initiation and die metaphorically. In order to come back and be mature and be responsible adults. And I'm going to throw in one more pop culture reference around that is the hit TV show, and I actually did not watch this until pandemic this year, Mom, with Allison Janney and Anna Anna someone, but it's about a mother and daughter who are both addicts, right? They're both alcoholics. And it's really good in that it very accurately addresses what it is like to have a parent, especially the mother archetype, who is an alcoholic or an addict in any way, who is unable to really fulfill the mother archetype, and then what it is like to be that Persephone, and the difference between being the Persephone Kore, who's the maiden who continues to be the eternal child and the victim, and the Persephone Queen of the Underworld, who takes charge of her life, who is able to master her addiction, stays clean and sober, take responsibility, and turn her life around. So while it's a kind of cheesy sitcom, it is profound in that way as a great example of this dynamic.
No, it's
sorry,
it's a
please forgive me.
Yeah, it's a personal issue for me because it's something that's touched people around me, and those addicts who've come out the other side, they've hit rock bottom, have actually thanked their mothers and their loved ones for letting them hit rock bottom, because if they hadn't hit rock bottom, they never would have sobered up. But back in the day, you know, there was alcohol and there was heroin, and it was possible to hit rock bottom and come out. But, you know, with things like meth, there's a particular line where once you cross that line, that's it. There is no coming back.
Yeah.
There's some scary drugs out there now, and why people choose to use them is absolutely beyond me.
Well, I do want to just say the one beautiful thing when somebody is able to recover and come back to go, you know, those that you said say thank you for letting me hit rock bottom, those are the ones that typically become, not only are they Persephone, Queen of the Underworld, but they can go on to become Demeter or Mother archetypes themselves.
Yes.
You know, they become the counselors, the sponsors.
Exactly.
Right, the therapists.
Exactly.
Because they know better than anyone else what it's like. Yeah.
So many counselors are addicts who've come back. Yeah, it's true.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So descents into the underworld, I don't know how much time we're going to have to address this, but descents into the underworld was sometimes part of initiations in ancient mystery schools. Could Persephone's path to individuation give us an additional insight into these initiations?
Well, again, I think, you know, we all descend into the underworld at some point, right?
Yeah.
And the difference is whether or not we feel abducted and we feel like the victim, or we rebel. Again, sometimes the addiction, the teen pregnancy, the illegal behavior as a kid is an inability to navigate our way into maturity and not having a parent that knows how to help us or assist us in doing that either, right? But when...
Yeah.
We are able to have somebody in the mother archetypal role who can assist us and provide us with some tools, just as the mother, just as Demeter does in the Spretnak version. Then we choose and we are able to navigate the process of individuation and the process into that initiation far better. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, we certainly, again, see that in every initiation that there is. Everything is an initiation. And the old, when you truly made men and women go through initiation ceremonies, you know, when you went into that very scared and feeling like you had no, and this is true in life today, and you don't know what it's going to be like. It's hard. It's really, really hard. And sometimes you don't make it. I often think of marriage as the same way. It is an initiation into a mystery. No, hear me out for 1 second or 1 minute. Marriage is it is one of the great mysteries, and particularly because as a culture we can decode it into a fantasy, into a myth of soulmates and happily ever after. And if you do not have someone in your life who sits you down beforehand and says, this is going to be hard. This is not everyday happy day. This is a daily commitment. You're going to go through some rough times. You may even go through some rough years. But boom, 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 boom. This is what this looks like. If you don't do that, you end up disillusioned, upset, and you feel like the victim. Right?
Yeah.
So that's always the difference. Is how conscious are we going into the initiation? How conscious are we growing up of what growing up means? And how much have our parents prepared us for this, which sometimes, you know, comes down to our parents not having been prepared to be parents. So not to make anyone bad or good, but there's a series of dominoes that happen now. And all of life is an initiation into the mystery to some point.
Yeah.
And I hate to interrupt, and I can't tell you how tempted I've been to jump into this conversation, but we have like 3 minutes left.
Oh, damn. Gosh, I wanted to talk a little bit more about underground initiations. I just wanted to quickly point out that for Christians, the underworld is something evil, it's demonic, it's something to be feared, but yet... For in pagan initiations, a descent into the underworld always results in the acquisition of knowledge and transformation. It's something very positive. So as Hercules pointed out, we're starting to run out of time. Are there any projects you're engaging in that you'd like to mention?
You know what? I know we're running out of time, but I want to say, and I can't say that I identify as a Christian anymore, but it certainly is the tradition I was raised in. And the idea of there is a fundamental idea of the fundamentalist conservative idea of hell, the underworld being a bad place. But true Christianity is built on this idea of the resurrection, of the journey through and out. So in that way, it acknowledges that the descent is absolutely essential in order to experience resurrection. And I think that's part of the great mysteries and in every initiation is that by going through a descent into the underworld, going into hell, going into a dark night of the soul, having a metaphorical death is the only way that we are transformed into new life. And that new life is important not only for ourselves and our own individuation and growth, it becomes important for the entire community. And with that, I will say, am I working on anything at the moment? you can find my work on academia.edu. Also, I'm writing two blogs. One is Finding Home on Substack, and I also have a podcast called Finding Home, which is pretty much just a reading at this point of my blog posts. That is on Spotify and about six other platforms. And then I have another blog post called JanPeplerHome.com. Did I miss anything?
Well, no, and the blog's JanPeplerHome.com. That's
correct.
All I have in front of me. But I wanted to thank you so much for coming on the show and letting us get to know you a little bit better. We need to have you back. At least to talk about Zeus and the father archetype. You privately mentioned that you've written a blog about Hera. There's so much more to talk about. If you want to, please.
I would absolutely love that. If you and Hercules would have me back, I'd be thrilled. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate talking about this.
I learned so much from you. It's a privilege and a delight having you on the show. I love having you here.
Well, let's just make them 2 hours. No, I'm kidding. No. Wonderful. Thank you both so much. Thank you, Hercules, for providing this platform. Thank you, Tony, for the questions and the invitation. And I
Thank
look forward
so
to
much,
doing
Jen.
It again.
Yes,
okay.
For sure.
Thanks to both of you. Take good care. To be continued.
Many
Thank
blessings.
You. Bye.
Okay. Ciao.
Ciao. And thanks to everybody from home. Until next time, this is all of us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures.